This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We have this week the very peculiar halacha of the Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave, who after his initial contract of 6 years, decides that he wants to stay longer. There's only one reason which is permitted to motivate that decision, and that is if the Eved has been given a wife by his master, which the master is allowed to do for the purpose of breeding slaves. So an Eved Ivri, you can have a Jew who has been sold into slavery, and the master says, I want to use this opportunity to breed little slaves, and therefore here is a nice wife for you, and he gives her, she gives him a shivcho knani, she gives him a non-Jewish slave, and the children that they have through that marriage are the property of the slave owner. But it can happen that the Eved becomes emotionally attached to his wife and children. And if he then says, Ahavti es Adoini, I love my master, es Ishti, my wife, es Bonai, my children, Lo yetzei chofshi, I don't want to go out. If I go out, I have to leave my family, my newly acquired family, and I would rather stay. Then he's permitted to stay until the Yovel. But a strange ritual takes place. The Gishe Adonov El HaElokim, Elo Elohim, and his master will bring him to the judges. The Gishe El HaDeles, and then we'll take him to the door, or El HaMezuzah, or to the doorpost. The Rotta Adonov Es Oznoi B'Marzea, and the master makes a hole in his ear with an awl. The Avodoi Lo'ilom, and he becomes his slave forever, which means until the Yovel. What is this act of making a hole in his ear? Is it a punishment? Is it a sign? What is it? It appears in the Mishnah to be a form of kinyan. Hanirtze nikne beritziya, the Mishnah says, that a slave who's going to be to work until the Yovel is acquired by the act of ritziya. It's an act of acquisition. But the Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Kaf Beis learns that there's a great deal of disapproval of this man's actions. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ayodoyre shes hamikra hazeh kemin chayme. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to learn this posuk in a way of a kind of a chayme. Chayme, strangely Rashi says, is a precious stone or a perfumed item which women sometimes wear around their necks. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai learned this like a kind of a necklace. It's very difficult to understand what the Gemara means by that. He asked, Ma nishtane oizin mikol eivorim shebeguf? Why the ear? That's what he wants to know. Why the ear? Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ribbono Shel Olam, Oizen Sheshomo Kili Al HaSinai V'Shor Sheomarti Kili B'nei Yisrael Avodim Ulei Avodim Le'Avodim. An ear which heard my voice when I said on Sinai, for B'nei Yisrael will be slaves to me and not slaves to slaves. V'holach Zeh V'Koma Odoim Le'Atzmoy, and this man went and he acquired a master for himself. Yirotso, let that ear be pierced. Very peculiar. Firstly, what's so terrible if he becomes a slave? It's becoming a Jewish slave, an Eved Ivri. An Eved Ivri is really a servant, not a slave. It's his job. But certainly he remains chayiv in all the mitzvahs. He still has to do all the mitzvahs. He's not freed from anything. And the master is not permitted to work him in such a way that he will not be able to fulfill the mitzvahs. That isn't allowed. So what does it bother the Ribbono Shel Olam? that he's becoming a servant. He's taken on, he's signed on a contract for a period of anything up to 50 years. And if it is such a terrible thing, what is the purpose of making a hole in his ear? We should either forbid it, or we should allow it. And if we allow it, what is the sense of this hole? What does it mean? And what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai mean when he says that he used to learn this pasuk like a kind of a necklace? What does that mean? A very strange and odd piece of Gemara. And also, he's criticized this ear, which heard my voice on Sinai when I said, "Ki li b'nei Yisrael avodim." He didn't hear that. That's what Ribbono Shel Olam said to Moshe. But that wasn't part of the Ten Commandments. That wasn't something which he heard himself. Much later on, it's in Vayikra. So how can he be blamed for not hearing it? He wants to say that it says in my Torah and he didn't learn it. But why does the Gemara use the lesson that he heard my voice on Sinai? And if it's talking in later generations of people who went to Sinai altogether? And that statement of Kili b'nei Yisrael avodim in Tevran in Vayikra is a statement used to explain why the Jewish people are obligated to redeem a Jewish slave sold to a non-Jew. Kili b'nei Yisrael avodim, because the b'nei Yisrael are my slaves and not a non-Jew slave. Go and redeem him. But that pasuk is not used to explain why a person shouldn't become a slave to a Jewish master. So why is there such criticism? This Gemara is very, very peculiar. Reb Simcha Zissel learns this Gemara in a different way altogether. He says, this that he's criticized for acquiring a master for himself, the master that he's being criticized for having acquired is not the owner. That's not the serious thing. The master that he's been criticized for owning, for becoming a slave to, is his own desires. When the man says, "I don't want to go out into freedom because ahavti es adini, es ishti, es bonai," so for the love of this shivcho knanis, for the love of this non-Jewish girl that you've been put together with for breeding purposes, for that you're prepared to sacrifice your freedom. She's your master, not the owner. The owner's not making you stay. The owner's willing to let you go. Who's holding you back into slavery? Your passion, your desire. You can't leave the shiksa. That's why you can't leave. And that's the Ozen Shoshana Tili Al Sinai Bishar Shamati Kili B'nei Yisrael Avodim. This ear which heard on Sinai me saying, "For B'nei Yisrael are my slaves, the Horach Zeva Kona Hodon Latzma," and this man has gone and taken on a new master. Who is that new master? Himself. He's becoming slave to himself in a way that he can't escape himself. That wasn't the intention of Yitzhak himself. And therefore that ear should be pierced. Helps us a little bit, it doesn't explain everything yet. The passions have a very strange way of operating. Imagine, for example, a sales lady who works in a shop, and she earns a little salary, she earns a little commission. And the salary and the commission is just enough to come out on, but nothing really to save. And every day on the way to work, she walks past a dress shop. And in the window of that dress shop, there is the most beautiful dress. And she goes into the dress shop, takes a few times of walking past before she plucks the courage to go in. And she goes in and she tries on the dress, and it fits her perfectly. And she looks magnificent in this dress. And she asks the price, and they tell her it's 250 rand. And her heart drops. 250 rand, where is she going to get 250 rand from? Each month she gets enough to come out, just to pay what she has to pay, a couple of cents that she can save, 250 rand, it's just, how is she going to do it? And she becomes obsessed with this dress. Every morning she walks past, and she looks.
and she imagines herself in it. And she dreams up an excuse a few weeks later to go in again and to ask to try it on again. And she looks at herself in the mirror and it's absolutely gorgeous. And she really wants it. And she tries to work hard, but it doesn't really help. So a little bit more commission, it doesn't help her much. She's not managing to save up. Eventually, after a long time, weeks and weeks and weeks, she saved up 100 rand. She saved up 50, 100 rand, let's say. And she goes into the shop and she says she's got 100 rand already. Would they take the 100 rand and keep the dress for her? Saving up. And the shopkeeper says, okay. He says, but not for an endless amount, I'll keep it for you for 6 months. And another month goes and another month goes, and then she has a problem at home, and then her car breaks down and she has to spend money on it, and she's just not getting the 150 rand together. One day, just before the 6 months are up, another month to go, she's standing in the shop and she sees the balabos is busy, he's selling, he's taking in money, and he's giving her the goods. And somebody gives him some money and he puts it down next to the tool and he carries on serving somebody else and goes away and he comes back and goes away. And she looks at the money next to the tool. And she looks and she sees three pink notes, 150 rand, lying there. And she walks up and down and she watches it and she watches it, and the balabos has forgotten about it. Here is anything he's forgotten right about it. He walks up and down past it, everybody else walks up, nobody sees it, nobody knows it. And she starts figuring out how easy it would be to just slip it into her bag, and she's got the dress. Finished. That's it. And she starts justifying it that it's theft, and she says, well, she'll pay it back one day, it's not really theft. And the balabos has already been miyayish from it, he doesn't even know that it's there anymore, and it's not going to make any difference, he's such a rich man in any case. And she's worked it all out. And nervously she's about to go and do the act. One thing she forgot, she looks up, and there's one of these eyes in the back, and she looks at this thing up and down this day. What happens? All of a sudden her desire for that 150 rand disappears completely. She no longer wants it. Gone! And she starts working extra hard. Maybe she can make a bit of extra commission, and that way she'll be able to get the dress. The desire for the dress hasn't gone. The desire to make that 150 rand up somehow, that hasn't gone. But the desire for those three pink notes, for that 150 rand, that disappeared and dissipated completely. Why? All of a sudden, the reality of the situation. And reality has that ability to put things into perspective. Once things are in perspective, our passions find their right places. What happens? They don't disappear. Of course there's still a desire. Of course there's a desire for the dress, but there's not a desire for theft. There's a desire for the money, but there's not a desire for the dishonesty. She sees the little eye up on the top, and she pictures a policeman, handcuffs, jail. Is it worth it? All of a sudden, it's just not worth it. The cost of taking that 150 rand is much, much greater than the benefits of having it. And so she loses all interest in it altogether. As any of us do, when we realize that something is totally out of our reach. One can have something which one likes, one hears about something, which is, it's very nice. There's a yacht going for sale, it's only 45 million rand, but it's an ocean-going yacht, it's a wonderful thing. And it's a bargain, they say. Normally they cost 65 million rand, this one's going for 45, it's a real bargain. How can you turn down a bargain? No, you're to her. Don't you like it?
I love it.
Wouldn't you like to own it?
I would love to.
So what's the problem? The problem is I can't. It's not within my realms of possibility at all. It doesn't affect me. You mean you can go to sleep at night knowing that you haven't bought that yacht at such a material? Yes, I can go to sleep at night. It doesn't bother me. Because it's totally beyond me. That's the reality of the situation. And we adjust to reality. The only time we don't adjust is when reality is not very clear. When we don't know what reality really is. When we try and talk ourselves into situations which are unreal. That's when we get a little confused. But when reality stares us in the face, when reality is real, when we feel it, when we see it, when we understand it, when we know it, there isn't much temptation when reality is clear. We said last week that the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was to relive the creation with Bnei Yisrael taking part in the act. The act of creation took place before humanity existed, and therefore humanity has no way of experiencing it. And something which humanity has not experienced cannot be known by humanity. It can be believed by humanity, it can be imagined by humanity, but it cannot be known. A person cannot know something which is totally outside of his experience. And therefore the Ribbono Shel Olam goes through the Yetzias Mitzrayim in a way which relives and reenacts the wonders of Sheshes Yemei Breishis, of the creation of the world. So that anybody who has lived through that Yetzias Mitzrayim has lived through something as wondrous as the creation of the world. And what he's seen is as clear that there is a creator, and he's been a part of that creation and active in that creation, that there can be no doubt in his mind at all. He has yediyah, as the Rambam says. He knows that the Ribbono Shel Olam is the first force, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is the one who created the world. He knows that. He doesn't believe it. He knows it. That was the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But for what reason? Why was it so important for Bnei Israel to know that? We said last week, because the motivating factor in Avodat Hashem, in the service of God, is that God created the world. And although the Ten Commandments start with saying, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, that's why you know, that's why it is within your experience that I created the world. But what really motivates you, what has to motivate you to keep the mitzvahs in the peculiar way which I desire you to keep those mitzvahs, that's the knowledge that I'm the creator of the world. And that's what obligates your observance of the mitzvahs. It is in response to the knowledge that I am the creator of the world. That's a knowledge which you did not have before Mitzrayim, and that's why the Torah wasn't given before Mitzrayim. You believed it, you knew it with prophecy, you knew it with all sorts of techniques. You believed it with all sorts of techniques, but you didn't know it because you had not experienced it. Once you've come out of Mitzrayim and you've stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, now you know that I am the creator. And that knowledge obligates you to serve me. That obligation, what does it mean to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam? We talk about service of God as avoda. And avoda means work. Avoda is the work which an eved does. So avoda Hashem really means being an eved Hashem. Avoda Hashem is the action of an eved Hashem. That God created the world obligates us to serve Him in the sense of an eved, in the sense of a slave. What does that mean? A slave is different to a worker, in that a worker, a sechir, only dedicates certain specific skills and talents of his to his balabos, to his employer. And that's agreed by negotiation, by contract. An eved is different. An eved gives everything to the owner. You can employ a man to be your butler. But if you say to the butler, go and mow the lawn, he'll say, I'm not your gardener. And he's entitled to say that. That's not what you employed me for. But you'll say, excuse me, butler, you've got nothing to do today. What are you going to do all day? He says, I've got nothing to do today. I'll do nothing today. None of your business what I'll do today. If you've got no work for me, I'll sit and do nothing. But I won't mow your lawn. If you've got an eved, no problem. If you've got an eved, you tell him to be a butler today, and to mow the lawn tomorrow, and to clean the car the next day, and to go out to the shops the day after. It makes no difference. He is there to do whatever you want him to do. Even to breed more slaves, you have the right to make him do that too. Because every part of his personality, every part of his ability, all his talents, all his skills, are all dedicated to the use of the master. That's what an eved is. When we talk of Avodas Hashem, that's what we mean. Avodas Hashem is not that there are certain things we need to do in service of God. Avodas Hashem is not that there is a certain part of our lives which we have to dedicate to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's not Avodas Hashem. That's all other religions are like that. All other religions require you at certain times to do things, to go through rituals and to do things for God, or for their idol, or for whatever they believe. But not so the Torah. When we talk about Avodas Hashem, about serving the Ribbono Shel Olam, we don't talk about rituals, and we don't talk about service, we talk about slavery. What we mean is that there is nothing that we do in our lives, from morning till night, from the day we're born until the day we die, that there is nothing at all that we do which is not in the interest of our balabos, of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Whatever we do is for the Ribbono Shel Olam. That means that there is not a drive in the human being, or a desire in the human being, a natural one, with which he was created, which cannot find expression within the framework of Avodas Hashem. All our passions, all our drives, and all our desires can all be fulfilled. They weren't created in us just to mislead us. They were all created for positive use if we choose to use them positively. And they can all be used within the framework of Avodas Hashem. A person has a desire to build businesses, it's no problem. That can be expressed in Avodas Hashem. A person has a desire to procreate, to have a family, no problem. That can be expressed in Avodas Hashem. And begins to understand the problems that the Catholics are having. Because they don't have a principle system of Avodas Hashem. They have rituals. And married life is an interference in their religious rituals. And therefore they cannot allow their holy people to get married. It's a profane thing to do. Well, that's not so at all. Since we talk of Avodas Hashem, there is nothing that we have an ability to do, and a natural skill, a natural talent, or a natural drive to do, which can't find its expression within the realms of the Torah, within the framework of Avodas Hashem. We have to express ourselves. We're expected to do. That's what the slave is. You have a slave, and he's a wonderful artist, and you've placed him as a slave. But you know that he has a wonderful talent as an artist. You're not going to expect him to mow the lawn all day and all night. You're going to want him to use his talents as well. So make some paintings. You'll sell them. They'll belong to me. That's your skill. That's what I bought too. When I bought you, I bought all your skills, including your skill of painting. No, says the slave, painting, that's my own private, that's my hobby. Says the balabos, you've got no hobbies. You're the full-time professional. There's nothing that you do for yourself. You're the slave. And all your talent, and all your efforts, and all your energies have to go to me. You're not a worker, you're not a sahir. That's what Nevid is. And I expect you to use your talents, not to use the things at which you're not talented. I bought you as an individual. I bought you as a human being. I didn't buy a machine. I didn't buy an ox. I bought a human being, and you're different from the other slaves. I bought you because of your difference, not because of your similarity to the others. And I want you to use your unique talents to promote my welfare. That's what you're there for. Of course, we do have the concept of avodim in limited senses. When one hires, for example, a very senior executive, you hire a junior person, you hire him for a very specific thing. His job is to make the tea, or her job is to type the letters. That's it. But if you hire a very much more senior person, you say, look, your job is to make this business flourish. That's what your job is. And one day you come into his office, and he's busy there with calculations. You say, what are you doing? I say, I'm busy, there's a business I'm going to start next week. My own business, I'm busy just working out. Oh, no, you don't. Your job is to make my business flourish, not to start your own businesses. That's what I've hired you for. So we also have the idea of limited avdus. But the avdus of the Torah is talking about a total avdus. And when we talk about being an eved to Hashem, when we talk about being slaves to Hashem, committed to avodas Hashem, to the slavery of Hashem, what we're talking about is dedicating all of our personality, our uniqueness, our talents, our skills, our drives, our ambitions. Everything goes to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Nothing's left out. Because we're an eved. One just has to find out how to use those drives and how to use those skills in the interests of our balabas. That's all we have to figure out. But we can't use them for ourselves. And it's that which turns what could be hedonistic and inward actions into actions of creativity and actions of kedusha. Whereas a person might find himself, for example, eating. Eating is on the surface a very animal action. That's something that animals do. It's very hedonistic, it's very self-centered. And yet if we do it correctly, if we have a Suda's mitzvah, if we say a bracha before and a bracha afterwards, if we're having guests at our table, people who need to be there, we can all of a sudden find that the fact that we're benefiting from the meal is only by the way. We're really performing an act of avodas Hashem. That's what we really do. Our benefit is a byproduct. That's all. And so it is with everything that we can do. It's not just a question of looking at it from the point of view, well, I've got to eat in order to be a good slave. That's also one way of looking at it. That's a lower level. Well, you say that even a slave gets food. And why is he eating? If he's a good slave, he'll say, I'm eating so that I can be strong and healthy to serve my balabos better. That's why I'm eating. That's already a good slave. But there's a much better slave, where the act of eating becomes totally selfless. I'm eating, why? Because we learned once many years ago when it came to some of the concepts of sukkahs with the ushpizim, the importance of having guests. It comes to the point the highest level of eating is where you say, look, the only reason I'm eating is because I have a guest who needs a meal and it's not nice for him to eat on his own, so I'm eating with him. That's when eating becomes totally selfless. The fact that I'm benefiting from eating, of course I'm benefiting from eating. The fact that if I didn't have these guests, I would have to eat in any case. But that's not why I'm eating now. This act of eating is totally selfless. This act of eating is my avodas Hashem. I'm doing this as part of my job, as part of my calling, as part of my mission, as part of the purpose for which I was created, to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. That everything I do should be a Kiddush Hashem. That everything I do should be a sanctification of the Ribbono Shel Olam's name. That somebody should see me doing it and through that come to a greater appreciation of what the Ribbono Shel Olam is really all about. What it is that he demands of people. What Kedusha is, what sanctity is, what a life of sanctity is. Then I begin to understand. Unfortunately, we live in a time where sometimes the reverse occurs. And where we're so involved with our hedonistic activities that we turn our avodas Hashem as a further self-indulgence. Now, avodas Hashem, instead of our self-indulgence becoming nullified to our avodas Hashem, our avodas Hashem becomes nullified to our self-indulgence. And the self-indulgence becomes the important thing. Somebody mentioned to Rachel Shudas today that he was at a Sudas mitzvah from people today. And there people were sitting and throwing peanuts at one another to attract each other's attention. I wanted to speak to somebody at the end of the room and throw the peanut at him. This is a Sudas mitzvah. That's how one elevates the act of eating, a religious act. And nobody said that the joke was not just throwing the peanuts at a couple of other people. Nobody even noticed. It was taken as quite ordinary. Didn't seem odd at all. The Rav gets up to say a Dvar Torah. So you think that's why they're there. So this mitzvah, they're there to hear the Dvar Torah. While he's eating, he's giving the Dvar Torah, they're carrying on eating. What does that mean if while a Rav is speaking, one carries on eating? What's the Iker and what's the Tochah? Is the Avodas Hashem the important thing or is the stomach the important thing? What does it mean? And sometimes it's an automatic action. A person sits there and just feeds himself with the chips. Goes on and on and on while the Rav is speaking. He's just, his hand goes from the chips to his mouth, from the chips to his mouth. From his... What does that mean? That means it's an animal at the trough. That's all. It's feeding time now. You can't interrupt him in the middle of feeding time. That's what it means. It's feeding time. The idea of elevating, of understanding that I'm only here for the spiritual things, the eating, that's just part of it. That's part of life. But the purpose is to elevate life. Not to deflate the Torah, not to deflate the Kiddush Hashem, elevate living. It's for that reason that we're so meticulous about things such as yura and snius. Yura is self-aggrandizement, where people use the mitzvahs for self-promotion. Very external emphasis on the mitzvahs. And how careful one has to be not to allow that to happen. The understanding of the essence of it, of the kedusha of the mitzvah. You know, it's very today if a young man, a frum young man, is sitting in a bus. Very often when he gets into a bus, he won't sit down, in case a woman will sit down next to him. But if he does sit down, and a woman does sit down next to him, he jumps up like a person with AIDS sat down next to him. He flies. And that's again seen as quite normal. Nobody looks around. The women are used to it, the men are used to it, the bus drivers are used to it. Oh, sugar, they take it in their stride. Rabbi Lulokin once got onto a bus and sat down. And a lady came and plants herself next to him. What did he do? Here you get the sneers. Here you get the Yura question. He turned to her and he said, "Do you know where such and such a street is?" He knew that they had just passed it. She said, "Oh my goodness, we just passed that street." And he said, "Thank you," and rang the bell and stopped to that. So that way, he was able to get himself out of the situation without causing the slightest bit of hurt. That's a rebellion of him. But nobody noticed that he was a tzaddik. Shame. Nobody noticed. All that effort for nothing? He was living in a time, and he was living in a world, where Kiddush Hashem meant the aggrandizement of Hashem, not the use of Hashem to self-aggrandize oneself. That's the difference. Everything was dedicated to that. And in that school, there was a distaste for an external emphasis on the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs were always done with such depth. As we said last night, there's sometimes one compares things in terms of how much inside there is and how much outside there is. In that world, there was a lot of inside. The more you dabbled, the more depth you found. Not very much outside. You didn't notice that much. Rav Elie told my father that his life changed when, as a little boy, he saw the Bisrael Salanta from the distance. And my father asked him, "What did the Bisrael Salanta look like?" And the baby said, "He looked like anybody else. You couldn't notice that he was a Rav even. Just looked like an ordinary person." That was the school from which they came. The boys in the yeshivas didn't grow beards until after they were married. Tzitzits were very seldom worn out, if ever, worn inside. And even after marriage, when the tzitzits were worn out, jackets were worn over them. So tzitzits were worn out, that's correct. But you never saw it, because people walked around with jackets. Today you find people that walk around in sandals and short pants with their tzitzits on. And a t-shirt. And they don't see anything wrong with it. They don't realize that it's a lot of outside and not enough inside. That's what it is. And that's where there's the lack of tzinius. Rebbeinu Shlomo wanted reality to be very clear. And in Yetzias Mitzrayim he recreated the Maaseh Bereishis. And that recreation of the Maaseh Bereishis, not confrontation with reality, the passions become easy to handle. They cease to be so overpowering. The passions are only overpowering when one can't fit them in. And one can't find place for them. I said we're living in a time where we're living in two worlds, or maybe in one world. The world is my world, and I'll use anything to promote myself, even the Torah. The world of Yetzias Mitzrayim was exactly the opposite. We're living in the Ribbono Shel Olam's world, and you will do nothing whatever that doesn't promote the Ribbono Shel Olam, because you are his slave. You have no right to do anything which doesn't promote the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's Eved Hashem. That's being a slave to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if we were able to be filled with the true impact of the acts of creation, if we saw it all happening before us, we would understand that that's what we're there for. We're there only to express and to magnify the Ribbono Shel Olam's name. Let's look at the Gemara in that light. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, "Manishtana uzen mikol evorim shebeguf." Why the ear more than any other limb of the body? Amar Hakadosh Baruch Hu, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, "Uzen sheshamor kli al Sinai b'shor shamarti kili b'nei Yisrael avodim v'le avodim l'avodim." That ear which heard my voice on Sinai at the time that I was saying kili b'nei Yisrael avodim, Bnei Yisrael are slaves to me and not slaves to slaves. Such an ear, who then went and acquired a master for himself, and as the Rabbi Solanta said, who is the master? Himself, he is the master. Yirotso, let that ear be pierced. Where did Hashem say, Kiliv in Yisrael Avodim? It's not, as it's printed in the Gemara, that Posukim Vayikra. The Kili B'nei Yisrael Avodim, when did Hashem say that? He said that throughout Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's what he was saying. He was saying, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt in order that you should be my slaves. And every miracle was saying that. And every action was saying that. And every event was saying that. And every word of the Torah says that. Everything says that. But sometimes we don't hear what's being said. And we see that that's the intention of the Gemara, because further on, the Gemara asks, Rabbi Shimon Berebi asks, why the door? Why must his ear be pierced at the door exactly? And he answers, it's that door and that mezuzah who were aiding, who were witnesses at the time that Hashem skipped over the Jewish houses. V'amalti, and I said at that time, Kili b'nei Yisrael avodim. At that time God didn't say Kili b'nei Yisrael avodim. That was said later on at Sinai. So we see quite clearly from the Gemara that when the Gemara says that he didn't hear me saying for Bnei Yisrael are slaves to me, that isn't referring to the Pasuk in Vayikra. The Pasuk in Vayikra is merely amplifying the theme and saying that's why you can't leave a Jew in non-Jewish hands as a slave. Because the whole purpose of coming out of Egypt was to be a slave to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the time that the Ribbono Shel Olam was saying, if you say, when did God say Kili B'nei Yisrael? The answer is, he was saying it all the time, non-stop, from the beginning of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right throughout until after Matan Torah, the Ribbono Shel Olam was saying that. The first Dibur is when Hashem said, Anochi Hashem Elokeichem Asher Yetzeiseichem Eretz Mitzrayim, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. That was saying, and you are my slaves. That's what he was saying all the time. As we said last night, sometimes we're outside people. And we relate to the outside of outside things. We don't hear the message. We hear things in such a superficial sense. We see things in such a superficial sense. We relate to things in such a superficial sense. But we don't hear what it's really saying. We don't analyze. We don't perceive. We don't penetrate into the depth. Because to penetrate into the depths, there needs to be depths. One can't use one's superficial intellect and one's superficial vision in order to understand depth. It's the depth of the soul which is able to perceive the soul of other things. And that's why the development of depth within an individual is so terribly important. It's not just developing an ability or a skill to learn in depth. That's not what we're talking about. There's a question of developing depth. Depth is a midah. Depth is a dimension of the personality. And here is where we face perhaps the essence of all the problems we've been talking about over the last weeks of the society in which we operate, both Jewish and non-Jewish, religious and irreligious. A society that is shallow. A society that lacks depth. Why it lacks depth? All sorts of reasons. Too busy. Life moves too fast, too much information to really digest. Depth can't be handled if we don't have a moment to let things settle. If the moment you're taught something and the next minute you're bombarded with something else,
And the two of them, nothing to do with each other. They don't even tie up. And then something else, and then you're rushing somewhere, and then you're rushing back. And there's no chance to develop a little bit of depth. The value system of the society in which we operate is all a skills-orientated value system. A value system of how to do things. If you look at the bookshops, you'll find an increasing proportion of non-fictional books on how-to. How to do this, how to do that, how to become rich, how to become good, how to become successful, how to speak publicly, how to get divorced, how to get married, all sorts of how-to books. And it's guaranteed success if you write a how-to book. If it reads well, it doesn't matter if it works or not, because you only find that out after you've bought the book, by which time the author's made his money already. As long as it sounds plausible and it's good reading with a little bit of humor, it's got to be entertaining and it's got to be light. It mustn't tax the intellect, because intellects don't buy those books. So it's got to be light. Now you watch everybody go home and put all their how-to books away somewhere in the bottom drawer. And as long as it's light and as long as it's entertaining and it's not too taxing and it's plausible, it just has to be vaguely plausible. And you want to quote a few cases of how so-and-so just tried it and look what happened to him. He became so wealthy so quickly, or he became so clever so quickly, or he became so happy so quickly. And you give a few such case studies of how it really happened. That's be rather superficial, because if you scratch too deeply, you'll find that there are many, many other factors which is not really the subject of your book, so you've got to skip those out and pretend they don't exist. And it's guaranteed success to make a lot of money. So if you want to know how to make a lot of money, write a how-to book and you'll make a lot of money. And our whole society revolves around how to be more efficient, how to be more productive. And there's enormous pressure on people in the how-to areas to spend time pondering why, to spend time analyzing, plumbing the depths of a concept, talking to somebody, exchanging ideas in an area which is not practical. It's just an area of understanding, a cultural area. There's no time for that. Nobody pays for that. The idea of a kollel is archaic. To pay people to sit and learn. To sit and learn to be what? To sit and learn to be nothing. That's not the purpose. That's not why they're there. They're sitting to learn for the sake of learning. That's what they're doing. So how can you pay them? How are they going to be productive? They're going to be productive. At least we'll have some people with a bit of depth. But then, of course, what happens very, very soon is the code of them start becoming how-to places. And they also start becoming affected, inevitably, by that atmosphere which surrounds everything. And one finds it's only yechidim, it's individuals, pockets of people here and there who are really involved in deeper matters. I met a charming doctor the other day, an elderly man who's done some wonderful work. And he was talking to me about how medicine has changed. Now, when he was a doctor, he was the first person to wish the parents Mazel Tov. And that was always so meaningful to him. He was there and he would say, Mazel Tov, it's a healthy little boy or a healthy little girl. And he would raise the children and be with the children and live through their difficulties and their simchas. At every simcha, the doctor would be there. At every tzorah nebuch, the doctor would be there, at their side, helping them, encouraging them. It was a human profession. And he said, that's gone. It's not a human profession anymore. And he said he was talking to a colleague of his in the States, and he said to his colleague, what would you do? He said to his colleague, are you a house doctor? He said, yes, I'm a house doctor. In America, a house doctor doesn't mean a doctor who visits in the house. It means a doctor who stays in his own house. And he says, yes, I'm a house doctor. So he said, what would you do if a patient of yours phones up, or his wife phones up and says, please, I'm terribly worried. My husband was sent home from work, and he's in a cold sweat, and he's finding difficulty breathing. He's got a terrible pain in his chest, and he's blue in the face, and I don't know what to do. So the doctor said, I would send an ambulance immediately and send him to the hospital. So this doctor, the elderly man, said, how long will all that take? Sending the ambulance, getting him to the hospital, getting him attended to in the hospital. How long would all that take in New York? And I said, it could take 3 hours. So this doctor says to him, the elderly man says to him, don't you realize that the first 2 hours are the most critical? and that if you got in your car and got there, you might be able to do something to save him. He says, don't you know medicine? If he's that bad, he's going to die in any case. That was the kind of reaction. And this elderly doctor said to me, what has happened? What's going on? What's it all about? So I turned to him and I said, how do you explain it? He says he thinks it's because doctors do nothing but medicine. They don't read. They're not involved in culture. They're not involved in music. They're not involved in art. There's nothing human about their training. And they've lost the human touch completely. They go into technical college, that's all. And this is a form of technical college, and they're learning how to do certain procedures, and that's all they're interested in, the performance of those procedures. And they've ceased to realize that they're in a human profession, dealing with real human beings. I was discussing with Reb Meir Soloveitchik, what about a doctor who says he hasn't got time to learn? We have such people. Can't learn, he's too busy. And Reb Meir looked me straight in the eye and he said, then you are under obligation to persuade that person to give up medicine. That's why. Because he'll be a rotten doctor, he'll kill people. And I didn't fully understand what Reb Meir was saying until the other day when I met this elderly doctor. He's not a Ben Torah, the elderly doctor. He's Jewish, but not Frum at all. And he needs to realize that he is only entitled to handle as many patients as he can handle humanly. And I said to Reb Meir, what happens if he can't make a living then? If he's going to reduce the number of patients to the point where he can handle each one humanly, he's not going to be able to make a living. He'll either have to charge them so much that nobody will come to him, or he can't live. And the mayor said, let him go into business. We don't need such doctors. We're going to see patients on an inhuman basis. The danger is too great. It's the danger not of being a good doctor or a bad doctor. It's a question of being a murderer or a moral human being. Because all you need is one patient to die. And to die why, said Reb Meir, not because he gave him the wrong drug or because he got there too late. That a good clinician can still avoid. To die because he wasn't given the right moral support. To die because he wasn't given enough warmth and understanding and time. That's what a person needs from the doctor more than anything else. And if a doctor isn't going to be able to do that, let him not be a doctor. And a doctor who's not in learning, a doctor who's not developing depth in his personality, he's not going to have the interest and the ability to do that. It will drain him. You find many doctors, in fact, who are drained by the human side of their profession. Can you believe it? Drained by the human side of their profession. That's what they find most draining. Why? Because their human tanks are empty. That's why, of course, they're drained by it. Because their life consists of no input in the human area. The doctor needs his learning more than anybody else. But it's not just the doctors, it's all of us. Because we all find ourselves more and more entering a mode of non-humanity, a mode of lacking depth, a mode where we're not getting input. And it doesn't help learning another Blat Gemara. And it doesn't help learning another Siman of Shulchan Aruch. If we're not learning with human depth, if we don't perceive the values in it, and the beauty of it, and the structure of it, and the understanding of it, and the neshoma, the spirituality of it, that doesn't give depth. So that gives another few pieces of information. So it's Torah information instead of secular information. But we're still merely filling up the information gathering areas of the brain. We're not filling up the depths of the soul until one really understands something and deepens oneself. And a great deal of depth is acquired through interpersonal relationships, just being together. And that's another area where we fail so badly. We'll be together if we need to for business, or we need to for a chavrusa, or we need to for some. But just to be together, to talk things over, to spend an evening quietly together. Just mark the time off in the diary. Tonight's out. Spending it with friends. What are we doing? We're not going to the movies, and we're not learning chavrusa. We're sitting as couples, two couples or three couples. We're sitting to talk about things that are important, just to experience a little bit of depth in our relationship, which is part of the purpose of this new group, or these new groups which we're trying to structure now, around this very shir, around the Motzei Shabbos shir, as an opportunity for people to explore a little bit with one another. Men and women sitting together, to try and understand a little bit, to use their depth, to express their depth, and to grow in their depth. And a person who's not deep can be listening to something of the most utmost depth, and all he'll hear is the surface. Because he only has surface skills. He doesn't have skills of depth. You have one person listening to a piece of music, and it's heavenly, it's sublime. And you'll have another person listening to the same piece of music. The one person will come out commenting on the skills with which the violinist played that phrase and that phrase, and this could have been played better and that could have been played better, and the other one comes out with tears in his eyes. Moved. It's done something to him. They've sat in the same concert. You hear two people sitting in a shiur, and you say afterwards, ask them what they learned, and one person can repeat the shiur from beginning to end. And it can be a shiur that's the subject of which was not disturbing people when they're sleeping, and he repeats the shiur from beginning to end, word for word, at the top of his voice in a bedroom where six people are sleeping. Didn't hear the shiur. He can repeat it from beginning to end, but he didn't hear it. What's happened? The ears are blocked. Why the ears, asks Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Why oizen mikol evorim shebeguf? Because the ear didn't hear. The ear is an amazing limb. It's the only sense, the ear really, perhaps the nose as well. The nose is, the sense of smell is also considered very spiritual. That's why we use smell on Motzei Shabbos, to encourage the Neshoma Yisera, that there's a direct access to the Neshoma through smell, but also through the ear. Not so much through the eye, and not so much through touch, and not through taste. The ear has the ability to move a person far more than anything else. We've often mentioned the eye is more dramatic. The impact that the impact of the effect on the eye is immediate and dramatic. But 5 minutes later it's gone. The impact on the ear is much slower. It's not so dramatic. It takes a while to sink in. But the ear is actually a hole right into the head. It absorbs right inside. The eye is just on the surface. Touch is on the surface. Taste is on the surface. But the ear takes the sound waves into the head, right inside, and absorbs them there. That's the ear. The ear is the sense of depth. If one has a neshoma, one uses one's ear. If one has depth, then one uses one's ear to hear the undertones, to hear the depth, to hear what's right underneath. That's why one uses the ear. I mentioned, I think, once before in a shiur, that with the eye, you can see the surface. You can't see below the surface with the eye. But with the ear, you can. By tapping on a piece of material and hearing the sound that it makes, you can judge by the sound exactly what material it is and how it's made up and what quality of material it is. By the sound, not by the sight. That's the quality of the ear. You see, when the trains used to go by in the old days, when you used to travel by train, a little man used to stand at the station tapping the wheels. He could hear by the sound whether the structure of the wheel was intact, or whether there was a crack in the wheel. You could hear with his ear, not with his eye. It was going by too fast, you couldn't see it. That's the power of the ear. You can see a substance. You can hear quality. You can't see quality. You can hear quality. But this ear wasn't working. Because this ear went through the whole experience of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the whole experience of Sinai. And what was I saying throughout morning, night, all the time, day after day, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, what was I saying? Ki li b'nei Yisrael avodim, v'le avodim li avodim. Yisrael are now my slaves, not other one's slaves. All their passions are to be dedicated to me. And he finds himself enslaved by his passions, unable to leave the shiksa. Can't do it. He's acquired a new master for himself. He didn't hear. But his defense to that is, what can I do? Isn't it natural? I've lived with this woman for 7 years. I've had children by her. Do you want me just to get up and go? They say, no, we don't want you to get up and go. We understand. That's why you can stay as a slave. It's too late already. You're already a slave. It's not that you're selling yourself now as a slave. You're a slave already. And you'll always be a slave. Loila. You should have thought of that before. Rashi brings the Mechilta. The Mechilta is a little bit different to the Gemara. The Mechilta says, Omer Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Oizin zoi sheshomo al ha-sinai lo tignoivu v'holof v'gona av tirtza. This ear which heard on Sinai, you shall not steal, and went and stole. Because this is a slave, we're talking here about a slave who was sold by the Bethdin. The only reason the Bethdin would sell a man into slavery is if he stole and was unable to pay, he had no assets to repay the balabos. Then he was sold as a slave in order to be able to repay the balabos. And Rashi brings the Loshon of the Mechilta, which is a little bit different. There the Loshon is, this man who heard thou shalt not steal and went and stole. Is that why his ear is pierced? Then everybody's ear should be pierced for every Avera. For Chilul Shabbos our ear should be pierced, because we heard on Sinai that you must keep Shabbos and you're not. For all the Averas, person doesn't need kosher, his ear should be pierced. Why? The answer is, his ear is not being pierced because he stole. His ear is being pierced because he didn't foresee the consequences of his theft. The consequences of theft are the possibility of slavery. Once you're in slavery, so he might say, what's so terrible about that? That 6 years, I work and I pay off my debt and that's the end of it. No. But during those 6 years, you're not your own balabos. He says, of course I'm my own balabos. All I've got to do is work for my master, but I will still learn Torah, and I will still say Kriya Shema every day and every night, and I will put on my tefillin, and I will keep Shabbos, and I will eat kashrus, lemahadrin. There's no problem. What's wrong? There's one thing we say to him, one thing you'll have no control of. Do you realize your master can give you a shiksa and make you live with her? And so what he says? So for 6 years, if that's the din, okay, then I'll get up and go back to my family. And what happens if you fall in love? I won't fall in love, he says. That's a person who hasn't seen right through to the end. He should have seen that the consequences of his theft could be that he might fall in love with a girl whom he met by no choice of his own and from whom he will not be able to part himself. And then he's going to become an avid loyal. That's why his ear is being pierced. He didn't understand and perceive fully the consequence of lo tignuv. Don't get yourself into that kind of debt, because you might find yourself leading a life after that which is entirely out of your control, going off in a direction which you would never have imagined possible. And how often does that happen to a person? Sometimes to parents. Parents, never. A child marries out, and you say to the parents, but it didn't happen suddenly. And they say, but it was so innocent at first, you know, they worked together, so they met, and once he took her out, a nice girl, we didn't think anything would be, took her out a few times, but he was going out with Jewish girls as well, it wasn't such a problem. It all seemed so innocent, all of a sudden. There's no such thing as all seems so innocent. If a relationship cannot lead to something productive, if an action must, if it's going to be followed, must lead to destruction, then the action mustn't be followed at the outset. When it's innocent, that's when it must be abandoned, not later on. Later on you're an eved. A free man's chance of making up his mind is while he's free, when the reality is clear to him, not afterwards. That was what we had in the Vilna Gaon Shiur this afternoon, the difference between the chochom and the ksil, the ability to project and to make your decisions on the basis of your projection, not on the basis of the now, of the here and now. The here and now, it's too late already. You can't make money out of the here and now anymore. The only people who are making money out of the here and now are the people who foresaw the here and now 5 years ago. Those are the ones who can make money out of the here and now. Now all you can do is project further and get ready for the next opportunity. And so it is with life all the time. One has to understand, one has to be able to project. That's the work of the chochmah. That's the work of the free man. And to make one's decisions when it's all innocent, when everything looks fine, to simply realize that the projection is no good. It's not going to lead anywhere good. Why do we pierce his ear? We ask, what's the good of piercing his ear? What's it going to do for him? He's already a slave. Says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Hayodorish samikra zeh kemin chomer. He learnt this posuk like a kind of a necklace. And women walk around with a beautiful gem around their neck, or with a lovely smelling perfume on some kind of, they used to have little lockets in which there was beautiful smelling perfume. What's the idea? When other people look, they get pleasure. looks gorgeous. Look at a woman bejeweled, looks fantastic. The person who looks gets pleasure. So when you look at the hole in the ear of the slave, it's for other people to understand. This is what became of a man who was enslaved. This was what became of a man who didn't understand, who had no depth. And when the Ribbono Shel Olam was saying, I am the Lord your God and Yisrael are my slaves and not slaves to slaves. They are not meant to be slaves to their passions. Their passions are meant to be enslaved to me. He didn't hear that. This man with a hole in his ear, this slave, this eternal slave, is the consequence of such a tragedy, of a man who was unable to hear. And through that, all who see such a person will understand the dangers of walking around this world superficially, of walking around this world with eyes but with no ears, with an ability to see but not to hear, with an ability to relate to things as they appear, to relate to things as they are on the surface, and not to understand deep down what's really being said, what really is the purpose. And that will induce into us a desire to meet the challenge of developing depth and understanding that that is critical and urgent and important. And when we allocate time for ourselves, we'll understand that there has to be times not only for the things we have to do, but there has to be time also for what we have to make of ourselves. But there has to be time for us to develop this depth, to extend the depth and to nurture the depth, so that the effectiveness of our ears, of our ability to hear the deep, deep down messages, messages that we send one another, and messages that the Torah sends us, and messages that the Ribbono Shel Olam sends us, and our ability to send out deep messages, that all of that will be enhanced and developed.